Hi everyone. So my name is Karina Garcia and I'm with the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. I'm joined by my colleague Katrina Anderson from the Center for Reproductive Rights. So we're here to talk about our joint report and collaboration called Nuestro Texas. Nuestro Texas is our like bilingual title for it, which we always get mixed up by. So Nuestro Texas is a human rights report on the state of reproductive health and rights for Latinas living in the lower Rio Grande Valley, which is the southern border of Texas and Mexico. So many of you are probably aware of the recent and devastating attacks on reproductive health and rights in Texas, but what we might not be so aware of is what Latinas are doing in the Rio Grande Valley to stand up and fight back. Our report documents the extent to which the fundamental human right to affordable health care is being denied to Latinas across the state of Texas, and in particular in the Rio Grande Valley, as well as the impact of the 2011 family planning cuts. Katrina will speak more about that in just a moment. I want to provide you with some context for this region of the country and for the work that our Texas activists are doing. How many people in the room, can you raise your hand if you've ever been to the Rio Grande Valley by any chance? Okay. Does anybody know anything about the areas called, you ever heard the word colonias or anything in that region? Okay, well I'm going to describe it a little bit. So our work in Texas, it didn't start with Wendy Davis, heroic as her effort really was. Our Texas Latina Advocacy Network started in 2007 with 5 or 6 activists. They worked tirelessly over the past 7 years to grow the network to what it is now. And they've overcome tremendous barriers, and I want to explain the region a little bit to demonstrate why that is. So the Rio Grande Valley is one of the poorest areas in the United States. There are high rates of unemployment. It's a very rural community. The regions where our activists live, the colonias, most of the colonias lack running water and electricity, roads, paved roads. Public transportation is extremely difficult to come by, if not impossible, for some of these areas. And there's a lot of mixed status families, meaning one or more family members are undocumented. Despite these challenges, our Latina Advocacy Network has grown from 5 or 6 activists in 2007 to over 1,000 today. And they've grown house by house and family by family. They've spread all across the 4 counties of the Rio Grande Valley and are now in Corpus Christi, Houston, San Antonio, and El Paso. They want health, dignity, and justice, and they're fighting tooth and nail for it. They organize health fairs, marches, speakouts, rallies. They do lobby visits with their elected officials. They build coalitions with different organizations fighting for health and justice. And a lot of their trainings are in people's homes. One of the ways that they do this, just to share a little bit about what we're talking about, is they drive in their van and they go very, very slowly, like through these very rural areas, and they take out a bullhorn. They call this the perifoneo. And so they're on the bullhorn, they're in the van, they're like driving slowly through the community, and they're like inviting people to come out to their meetings. And so they're like, you know, good morning, Colonia La Fruta. You know, today at 9:30 in the morning, after you've dropped off your kids at school, join us at Doña Dorita's house. We're going to have bingo, raffles, you know, and come and bring a friend. And so they just keep like going through and like saying these things, and then they get people together this way. And so they get people together, they're at somebody's house, and they tell the women, all right, everybody, you ready to play some bingo? Yes! Are you ready to play some bingo? Yes! Okay, first we're going to talk about cervical cancer, and then we're going to play some bingo. And they get people together this way, and they have these meetings. They bring these women out of their houses. A lot of the women are afraid to come out of their houses. They're undocumented and living in isolation, living in, you know, situations of violence, and just bringing them together and talking about their health, right, and their lives and their futures, and training them to be advocates and to be organizers and activists and fighters in their communities really transformed who they are as individuals and what they represent in their community. And so I think that gives you a sense of what they're doing. This project has been a really outstanding project for us to work with the Center for Reproductive Rights. There's such different organizations, but we've been able to lift up these stories of what's happening to the women in the Rio Grande Valley, And it's really, they're not the same anymore. They're not afraid anymore. They're coming out and they're standing up and they're saying, we want a different Texas. We want change. And we're not going to sit by and accept these violations on our rights and our dignity. And they're not going back.
Thanks, Mina. Hi, everyone, and I just wanted to say thank you to the Committee on Women's Rights for inviting us to be here. It's really excellent to have an interdisciplinary conversation, so we really appreciate the invitation. I'm going to provide more detail about our documentation and our advocacy goals for this project. I also urge you to take a report. They're on the table outside. We really don't want to go home with them, so we hope that you will take them. The Center for Reproductive Rights is a legal organization that uses a combination of legal strategies, litigation, policy, and also human rights documentation and advocacy. We're best known in the United States for our litigation work, such as our challenge to the North Carolina law that was mentioned in the prior paper, but we also use human rights documentation and strategies in the United States, and that's what this project is. I want to describe a bit more about the policies that drove us to this point in Texas to give you a bit of a background. Texas is on the forefront of a radical experiment to redesign the provision of family planning. So in addition to being able to provide a tool, an advocacy tool, to the women in the Rio Grande Valley, we also wanted to provide a report, a documentation tool that advocates across the country could use in their states to expose the harms that this family planning redesign has caused in Texas in hopes of being able to urge a more cautious approach to lawmakers in other states. We have no financial relationships to disclose or conflicts. So in 2011, what happened? The Texas legislature, which meets every 2 years, cut its family planning budget by two-thirds. It also implemented a priority funding scheme, which was designed in order to ensure that all family planning funds went first to health departments and community health centers with no funds left over for family planning clinics that were on the lowest tier. These are the clinics that are often in the frontline providers in very rural areas of the United States, especially. It also implemented what's called, or started to enforce what's called an affiliate rule. This was really targeting Planned Parenthood in the state. It basically said that any entity that had a brand affiliation with abortion clinics could not receive state family planning funding. Planned Parenthood was the state's largest provider, serving 45% of family planning clients in the year prior to this. As a consequence of these actions, the federal government withheld the Medicaid family planning expansion, decided not to renew that, and also decided to award a Title X grant for family planning to an independent association, depriving the state of those additional funds. The statewide impact was immediate and severe. First, there was extensive damage to the provider network. 76 clinics out of the 300 funded by the state were closed. Family planning clinics, of course, were the hardest hit. So 39% of them lost support and 56 were forced to close entirely. Dozens of others were forced to cut hours, reduce staff, and limit subsidized services. And these providers have particular expertise in providing family planning counseling and services to immigrants and low-income communities like the ones in the Rio Grande Valley. So their loss was particularly devastating for these areas. And it's important to note that before this, Texas already had a provider crisis. There were fewer providers in 2010 than 9 years before. The second impact was that fewer women were served. 40%, there was a 40% decrease in women served compared to 2010. And for context, just to say that Texas ranks last among all states in the number of women served who are in need of publicly funded contraception. So they already were doing badly, and these cuts just really reinforced that and drove it to a different level. And finally, there was less efficient service delivery. So the cost per patient increased by 15% following the cuts because they were not distributing the funds to the most efficient providers. I'll just note here that the levels of funding were then subsequently restored in 2013 by the legislature, but they didn't restore it to family planning clinics. They kept in place the tiered structure, and they created a new program called Expanded Primary Care, and it earmarked 60% of the new funding for family planning, but not to the clinics who were the most effective providers. We're still assessing the impact of this new program. And moving forward in 2015, in January, the legislature is expected to make further changes, which will not include directing funds to family planning clinics. Now, Karina spoke about the Lower Rio Grande Valley, but just to give you an idea, this is a map that shows the four counties of the valley. We chose to focus on this area for this project in part because of Latina Institute's strong commitment to the region, but also because of the disproportionate impact of the loss of funding and the affiliate rule in this part of the state. It's home to 1.3 million people. Over a quarter is foreign-born. Texas has the fastest growing immigrant population in all states. And the Latinos and foreign-born immigrants are concentrated in the border counties of Texas. 90% of the population in the valley is Latino. They have the highest population of farm workers of any area in the United States. Texas Latinos are nearly three times as likely to live in poverty as whites are, but the rates of poverty are also much higher in the border counties, with over one-third of the population in the valley living in poverty. Texas also has the highest percentage of uninsured, the highest population of uninsured in the United States, and also, interestingly, the highest number of uninsured women of any state. But Hidalgo County, sort of right in the middle here, has the highest rate of uninsured people of any urban county in the United States. There are also incredibly poor sexual and reproductive health outcomes in the valley. For example, the health region that includes the Rio Grande Valley has the highest rate of teen pregnancy and teen birth rate in the state, also in a state that has the highest teen pregnancy rate in the country. And it's been disproportionately impacted by the cuts, as I mentioned before. This is in part because it's a very rural area and also because it's a medically underserved area as designated by the federal government. Hidalgo County, for example, has half the number of primary care providers and OBGYNs as similarly populated counties in Texas. Cervical cancer is particularly alarming in the valley. The incidence rate in Texas is 19% higher than the national average, but in the border, it's more severe. Women living in border counties of Texas are 31% more likely to die than those in non-border counties, and the incidence rate is higher. Lack of access plays a really key role here. Texas Latinos are more likely than other racial and ethnic groups in Texas to report having no access to a Pap test in the last 3 years. So our report aimed to delve deeper into the particular barriers to healthcare, but also to show how the impact of these policy changes were exacerbating these barriers. We also wanted to document the corresponding impacts on women's reproductive health and their other human rights. So in terms of our methodology, we conducted individual interviews and talked to groups of women in their homes, their churches, their community centers, and talked to 188 women total. We used human rights documentation methodology. This does not purport to be a qualitative research study, but we did follow best practices and ethical guidelines such as around confidentiality and consent. You will see some photos of women. All the names are pseudonyms. The photos is one area that we decided was important because the women demanded it. They actually really wanted to be at the forefront of the advocacy for this campaign, and they wanted a tool that showed their photo. And so we negotiated this in extensive, both with oral and written consent with the women, and repeatedly every time we used their image. So the report also launched a campaign, and this is really important to note, but I'll get back to that later. I'm going to provide an overview of the top-line findings, starting with the barriers, and I'm going to, in the spirit of keeping the women's stories central, I'm going to read some quotes. The first barrier that we found was just a lack of access to any clinics. The clinics had closed. Women were not able to get appointments at any of the remaining clinics because of the increased demand. So Felicia said, all of us here want to get a Pap test, complete checkups. We know that it's better to get ourselves checked in time, but we can't find a place. I need a checkup, but I don't know where to go. The second barrier was cost, the incredible cost of services and contraception, especially bearing in mind the level of poverty. So Ida says, it's $60 for a checkup. I thought either I pay $60 or I buy food for my children. This is a recurring theme. Either I pay the rent and give my children a place to live, or I have a mammogram, a pap test, or contraceptives. It's one or the other, but not both. Many women said that, especially those using LARCs, they're strongly preferred in the Latino community. They were unable to continue using them because the clinics had raised insertion fees, or they simply weren't stocking them because they were trying to prioritize other cheaper methods. So you'll see from this slide that women's reported use of regular contraception was severely interrupted after the family planning cuts took effect. Another barrier was transportation in this very rural area. So Adriana says, I have to catch the bus at 7 a.m. to get there more or less by 12 p.m. I have to take two buses. If I arrive late to the bus station, the next bus doesn't come until 5 p.m., and I would have no way to get back home. It's the only way I have to get around. Women with access to private transportation are often experience other barriers. They have no driver's licenses or valid registration, or they have to depend on friends and neighbors and their schedules to drive them to clinics. Public transportation is very difficult, as you see, with only two counties in the valley having bus systems, and the intra-county bus systems are very difficult to navigate. Immigration status is another barrier. A promotora we interviewed from Brownsville, promotora's community health worker, said many women are here illegally, which prevents them from seeking help at the clinics because they don't have the ID clinics want. Before the clinic will provide services, they need to approve you. They ask for ID, right? And if people are not legal, if their immigration status is not right, or if they have no ID, then it gets really hard. They are refused service. And ID here means both proof of residency in Texas, as well as proof of income. I think she was using this more liberally to talk also about proof of income to qualify for subsidized services. So this quote demonstrates the barriers once women get to clinics, but also immigration status prevents women from leaving their communities at all because they're so afraid about being picked up by Customs and Border Patrol. So now I'll turn to the impacts. The first impact we found was delays in getting care at all, particularly around cancer screenings. Brenda said it costs about $50, I think, just to see a doctor. If you need a mammogram or something, that's extra. I tried getting an appointment, but I was told all the slots were taken to try again next month. Next month, same story. I don't feel well right now, but whatever it is, it's temporary, and I'll just wait till it goes away on its own. Brenda is a domestic violence survivor, a single mother. She doesn't have time to wait. So we saw this come up time and again in the interviews where women were saying, I've found a breast lump. I'm experiencing spotting, really troubling signs. I know what this means or could mean. They had received information from promotoras who had talked to them and educated them about their reproductive health, and they had nowhere to go to get care. Untreated chronic conditions. Rosa says, half a year later, I went back in case they had funding again because my problem was getting worse and I was feeling sick. But it was the same story, no funding. 6 months later, I ended up in the hospital. Rosa had waited over a year until she finally qualified for surgery to remove an ovarian cyst. But in the meantime, she couldn't afford medication to control the pain. So women talked a lot about the fear and anxiety about not knowing the status of their reproductive health, having to wait interminably, the burden that put on their families. And unattended pregnancy also. Esmeralda said, then they took the funding for contraceptives away and I couldn't get them for free anymore. It cost $50 a month, but I can barely make ends meet. That's when I got pregnant. She experienced an unattended pregnancy with her sixth child. During her pregnancy, her husband was killed in a car crash, and leaving her as the sole support for her children. So these women often found themselves with unintended pregnancies, but they were already living in quite precarious economic situations. So the human rights violations that we identified in the report include the right to life, the right to health, the right to privacy and reproductive autonomy, the rights to non-discrimination and equality, and freedom from ill treatment. These are human rights that the United States has agreed to in a series of international human rights treaties and other documents, and they are binding on the federal and state governments to enforce them. Although we know that the economic arguments for prevention and family planning are likely to carry more weight with the Texas legislature than rights-based ones, we feel it was really important to have a human rights report for a number of reasons. Women leading the campaign wanted to emphasize that these policies impacted every aspect of their lives, number one. Number two, they wanted to talk about how they had structural barriers to care. It wasn't just the policies, it was also transportation, and we needed to be addressing this just as importantly as the funding issue. Number three, it surfaced the intersectional forms of discrimination that they face on a daily basis on the grounds of gender, race and ethnicity, immigration status, and poverty. They also felt that once they were educated about their human rights, they felt transformed, as Karina said. They never believed that they had claims to these rights before as non-citizens, as many of them were, or that they could venture to the state capitol or even to their local elected official's office to demand them. When women understood that these are rights that they could claim, they became direct participants in the advocacy and are now leading it at all levels, at the state, national, and international levels, notwithstanding the many risks that they face in speaking out. For example, one of the main promotoras came with us to Geneva back in March to testify before the UN Human Rights Committee about the situation in the Valley. The committee listened and they issued recommendations aimed at the federal government to lift restrictions on immigrants' access to public insurance coverage. These are restrictions that are embedded in the Affordable Care Act and Medicaid. And this was a really important recognition that the human right to health applies to all within U.S. borders, not just citizens. So we are following up on that. What's next? We are now crafting a policy agenda for the next legislative session in Texas that draws on human rights principles and goes deeper on our recommendations in the report. These are some of the ones that we plan on making. And we also are planning on holding a human rights hearing in the Valley in which we will time it to International Women's Day to keep the spotlight on Latinas and immigrants and women of the Valley as the Texas legislature meets to once again rehash how family planning dollars are spent and where they go. So these are the, I won't take you through in depth these recommendations, but these are the words in italics are the principles that we think are important to highlight: participation, affordability, availability, equity, non-discrimination, accountability, autonomy, universality, and indivisibility. So we hope that you'll join us in our efforts, and we thank you for listening. Please don't forget to grab a report, and happy to answer any questions.
But if you don't mind this informal sort of thing. So questions, please. Yes?
I have a couple questions. First, the first presenter, the places that you did your interview, were they from a variety of states? Were they from a particular part of the country?
Basically from a single state in the Midwest. And so in terms of the 15 was state level, so part of the Maryland state government, the state administration of the region. Of the 19 that were local programs, it was 4-4-4. 4 were local health departments, 4 were school-based, 4 were hospital-based, which was one of the major there, 19 was 12-7. 7 were local social service agencies.
The main one thing is like the attitude that the home visitors had might have reflected an environment in the state.
Certainly, and that's my joke about large and western states, is they're boxy, there's some tropics in the corner, and you have to cover the whole state that is combined with suburban, rural, small cities. Not as much as I would have expected. I did have a mix of metropolitan, suburban, and rural, small city placements, that I didn't see clear the geographic variations the way I expected to. Really what popped to me there was that the professionalism of the supervisor in being a gatekeeper, even if that supervisor indicated that they had personal reservations, they knew what was supposed to happen next according to the model, according to the program, and the good news was that they generally followed it. What shocked me was that they didn't interact much with the blind staff in that review. Kind of the theme that we're going here was that they took it upon themselves to make sure.
I'm also just wondering if the curriculum, who said that their intervention with the mom had a curriculum, if the curriculum included any information around family planning, or maybe that's another place where some of that stuff could be.
Not very much. Again, I think that's the case. So usually the curriculum is pretty child development focused. Your baby at 3 months, your baby at 6 months, and not that way. But certainly design of the program is not so much that home visitors would have to do the education, even though many of them probably could have, which that they get linked to other services, and that they that the program records that they have access and that they're using other services.
I have a question about Indian and churches. First of all, is the surrogacy she was looking upon as a form of abusive women?
Can you repeat that, please?
Is it looked upon as a form of abuse of women?
It is not.
And the use of cesarean section, is it universal in India to do a cesarean section for twins? And is that why these patients are having it, or is it just that they are going to use cesarean section on these women irrespective of what the general practice is?
No, the general practice is not to have a C-section. I think it is used more here, so you know, they're making sure that everything goes okay and consider to be safe.
If you knew if when a woman called, can they schedule their phone appointment
schedule a phone appointment, then make sure they do that and only then able to get on the schedule for the procedure.
I think that typically they get both appointments at the same time. So it just becomes an issue if they miss the counseling, the telephone appointment, and then they have to get pushed back in the schedule.
I think that that's really good that they're able to get the information over the phone, because the other thing that we found in Utah is that women didn't mind too much the information, like they thought it was sort of annoying, but they were fine with it. But what was really hard for them was to do two in-person visits, especially if they lived far away.
It's double-edged, because it definitely helps patients, but I think on the provider side, they talked a lot about how it was awkward to do this kind of counseling over the phone with someone that you've never met in real life, and that it was really difficult for patient-provider rapport. So, I mean, and they wouldn't trade it, they wouldn't, you know, for anything to make patients come in, but it was not sort of an unqualified good.
Have any women left the state or left the area to other places that have primary legislation? We didn't have another question, but I can't remember. I'll start with that one.
These women, the levels of poverty really prevent them from leaving. We are looking into doing follow-up documentation, particularly around the impact of the abortion restrictions in the Rio Grande Valley, potentially connected with the campaign, potentially just as separately as organizations. We do know, what did surface in our interviews is that women talked a lot about going across the border to Mexico for temporary periods of time to get care. But that was a very fraught situation in its own right. For number one, because of the border violence, and in Tamaulipas state, just across the border from the Rio Grande Valley, the levels of violence have skyrocketed since 2010 for reasons affiliated with narco trafficking. And so there's a lot of random violence. One woman we interviewed said she had been caught in three different shootouts on the streets, just trying to go across the border to get her long-acting contraceptive shot. So there was considerable fear about traveling to Mexico. Because of gender-based violence, in particular, like rape and sexual assault, and carjackings, everything else. There was danger associated with just the border crossing itself. So some women we talked to had gone across the border, but they couldn't get back, right, without taking illegal measures. And so one woman who went and had emergency surgery, she had been hemorrhaging so badly that she couldn't get care in the United States because she was uninsured, so she went to Mexico. Her mother took her to Mexico. She couldn't get across the border again, so she swam back across after having just had surgery, just so she could be reunited with her children. She's since been deported again. So it's just this very precarious situation that women live in, and getting health care is one among many problems, but certainly a huge one.
I think our contingency plan is to build a movement that's so strong that these kinds of things just can't happen anymore, that this is like the tip of the iceberg, that the situation in Texas was bad before the cuts, right? And so it's sort of like now we're like gathering our troops and saying like, you feel it now? Like we're really feeling it, aren't we? Like we can't accept these like controversial, if there's anything controversial about it, it's healthcare. It's basic healthcare, and it's about respecting people's decisions to make whatever decision they want to make about their lives and their families, and respecting women. And so it's like for us, we're really using this this report to lift up those stories, to show people what does it really mean. What does it really mean when you're attacking this one issue? What are the impacts that it has the stories that Katrina was mentioning about women who are facing, and this is even, you know, regardless of abortion, right? Like, abortion is one thing and we'll fight for it. But we're talking about, like, basic health care. Like, the women that we're talking about are, like, they can't afford to get care in the United States, right? They can't go to Mexico because then they're afraid they won't be able to come back. So they're in this terrible situation that is actually not so dissimilar from what other working class people in the United States are facing, which is that health care is twice as expensive in this country than it is in any other developed country. And so, like, our fight is, like, to make that fight for health care, that human right to health care, to make it as big and as powerful as we can, and to use this report as an example of what it really means, right, and why we have to come together and why we have to fight for immigrant rights, for health care, for, you know, these basic things that we all deserve, and that it really doesn't matter where people come from. It doesn't really matter. That's not the situation. Healthcare is a human right, and we have to fight to make Texas and the country respect that. And so this project has been really great for us because we've been able to use it to present our findings in different places in Texas and to say, like, the story doesn't end there, right? Those women who shared their stories, they are now leaders in their community, organizing groups of women to go to Austin to say, we deserve health care. And not only health care, we want justice, we want everything. And, like, organizing and showing people what it looks like. And it's unfortunate we weren't able to show you a video, but if you look at our website, we have the testimonials and we have videos of what our activists are doing. And the video is so great because you see the women, and they're not primarily as victims, although they are victims in some respect of these terrible policies, but it shows them as fighters, right? And they don't want sympathy, they want justice. And so they're building a movement, and this has allowed us to, it's a tool that we're using to spread that movement and to grow it. And so that this won't happen to our children and their children's children, that we don't have to accept this. There's no reason why we can't have universal health care in this country. None at all. But we have to organize our communities to fight for it.
We're clapping for you. The powerful labor to approach. Yes,
I also have a question for Noyce Joseph, the energy team. First, thank you so much. This is a really great presentation and such an important issue. I really applaud the work that you're doing. I can't wait to read your full report. And similarly, I'm curious about the response you've gotten to this report. If you've talked to those officials, what their response has been, what your plans are for dissemination, any way that we can, like, put our voice behind it. This is really great work.
Yeah, I mean, we've had, as Karina mentioned, we've taken it and launched it across different cities in Texas, and at each of those cities, we've had elected officials, usually representatives to the state legislature, who've introduced the report and been on board. Certainly, it has support in the Valley among elected officials. So there is definitely some support. Most importantly, I think what it's done is enabled the coalitions of advocates in Texas who are working on family planning, reproductive health, to be able to have a tool for them as well, because they have the analysis, but they don't have the stories, and they don't have access to any of these women. So they've really opened up their spaces to make sure that there is always a space for women from the Valley to be able to come to the legislature and testify, and have also opened up their policy circles to us, which has been great. So now I really feel like the biggest difference that we've been able to make so far is making sure that to have an analysis about how the policies affect the most underserved areas of the state, and that is definitely, I think, driving a lot of the advocacy. It's a long-term fight for change in Texas, and much of that will happen through demographics, demographic shift, and, as you know, of course, like, through building the political power. So our vision is to, in the meantime, make sure that we know exactly what we're advocating for, and to be able to show that if you're contemplating further changes, this is what you've done so far, right? We don't want to go back to this place, so let's think about a different kind of direction. So we're trying to propose other policies, too, that would be palatable to both political parties. For example, investing in mobile health clinics in rural areas. You know, that's something that now the Republicans, who are really intent on slashing family planning funding, they see that that's a low-cost solution that can solve a lot of problems, for, you know, economic problems for the state. So we're trying to come up with more frontline messages, short-term, you know, policy solutions that everyone can get behind as we push for the longer-term ones. Thanks.
And we've used this report to build with other movements, right? Like that,
yeah.
Like we're talking about the same. One person had like faces so many different forms of oppression that like we're talking about like a domestic worker who's not getting paid her wages, right? And who you know is undocumented, and then who is not being able to access healthcare, and so like. All those kinds of different organizations, the worker organizations that are fighting for wages, and the reproductive health organizations that are fighting for access, and women's organizations that are fighting for equality. Like, we've been able to bring these different groups together and say, like, let's build a bigger, broader movement. Like, we don't just have to say, like, I'm only for immigrant rights and I'm only going to organize around this. We can talk about health and reproductive health in our immigrant rights circles, right? And in our reproductive health circles, we could talk about dignity on the job, and we can talk about worker struggles, and that affects us too. And so, like, they've been able to do create these, like, concrete coalitions, like, almost immediately after putting out this report, that they were bringing people together and saying, like, let's broaden our movement, like, let's fight together.
We have time for one more question, if anybody has one. I think we'll end it there to respect the time. The Committee on Women's Rights and myself thank you, the audience, for participating, and our lovely speakers.